Well, greetings, listeners. Welcome to the Cold Fusion Now podcast, where we bring you the latest developments in the science and engineering of Cold Fusion Leonard. I'm your host, Ruby Carrot. I'm speaking today with Alan Smith, director of LookingForHeat.com, an online shop dedicated to supplying open science research with laboratory needs. Alan has spent a career in various fields related to materials research and engineering, with a focus on polymers. He is also the author of books on craft subjects and is currently a moderator on Leonard Forum. Alan, thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure, Ruby. Yes. Yeah. I always look forward to hearing your little interventions into the world of Leonard. They are a joy at times. Yes.
Well, thank you very much. Well, Alan, I want to know about LookingForHeat.com. This is one of the first commercial businesses to come up since the Martin Fleischmann Memorial Project started back in 2012, I believe. How did you get started with LookingForHeat.com? And also, describe for us, what is it you provide these open science researchers?
Okay. The genesis of Looking for Heat was at the ICCF 19 in Padua. Being a sinner and a smoker, I spent some of my time outside the venue. And a fellow nicotine addict, Sam Hansen, was also interested in the conference and attending. And Sam is not a technical person. He's pretty smart, but he's more of a web guy than a technical guy. And we got talking about the whole field, and he said to me, "Well, it seems to be in a state of paralysis." So I am a radio amateur, amongst other the sins of my past, and I began to talk and to speculate with him about the way that in the early days of radio, between about 1910 and 1930, technical innovation and advance in radio was entirely driven by amateurs. Yeah, they were the guys who came up with ideas about supersets and began to explore VHF and so on. As well as opening up shortwave radio and the whole transmit-receive business. And so I said, it seems to me that a business like that would actually help. I knew it was difficult because had faced a few problems myself buying chemicals and materials for my own beginning research into Leonard, cold fusion, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And so I said to him, maybe it will be, there is a business model here that we could create by providing equipment at very real, you know, very realistic prices, a versatile lab rat, a petri dish, if you like, in which Leonard researchers, garage researchers, gentlemen scientists, as I like to think of them, could actually carry on and get the things that they needed, and that we would have a group of people. We would be able to form a group of people who had the same equipment, the same basic equipment to carry out their research with, that we could kind of crowdsource some systems, some reliable systems of producing Leonard effects, anomalous heat, radiation, whatever it was. Yeah. And so we would gradually form this group of researchers. We would share information. We would publish our results, whether it was internally or externally, and so on. And Sam thought it was a good idea too. And at the same conference, we had the good fortune to meet an American researcher, Clee Irwin, who is the head researcher at something called the Quantum Gravity Corporation in California. Mm-hmm. And we got talking to Clee about it. And Clee said that he would give us some modest funding to start this business off, which he very kindly did. And this was, well, it must be, I think, March of, gosh, yeah, it's almost 2 years now. Almost 2 years we've been running looking for heat. And in that time, we have developed what is a very capable low-cost reactor system. I mean, you know, the most lavish system we produce, which has got two channels controlled and the test channel and a data logging, so on, is only about $750. So we've managed to sell quite a few and donate some as well. Altogether, I think I've put together about 20 reactors, of which 15 have gone to private individuals. Two have gone to big motor companies, and I'm not even going to tell you their name because they wouldn't like it, who are interested in Lennar. But they're both somewhere east of Cairo, as it were. I can tell you that much. And they also, there are a couple of universities. There's one in Ukraine and there's one in Sweden, though. And for a while I had one in Italy as well. But not much has come out of the universities or the motor companies, I'm afraid, the commercial customers. But I must confess that the business model has failed in that we send out the reactors, we encourage people to communicate, and often they send us back pictures of nicely assembled reactors and say, oh, this is good, I'm really pleased with it. But they never tell us what their results are. They never share their research. And it's almost by luck that the client we have who's had most success in terms of that he's managed to achieve what appears to be, though I haven't seen it yet myself, reliable ignition, excess heat, radiation signals, some very fascinating work, happens to be not 20 miles from where I live. It's lucky he could have been in Timbuktu because that's the nature of the web and so on. And we distribute all over the world, but it just so happens it is 20 miles away from me. And in a few weeks' time, I hope to have in my hand a fuel sample from him that I can run in my machine here and kind of independently confirm his results and so on. So that's really exciting, actually. That is our one, the one big success that's made all this worthwhile. Mm-hmm. But the idea of crowdsourcing research into Lennar is obviously a non-starter. The other thing I was amazed with is how small the pool of actual experimenters is. Yeah, I thought that maybe there would be 500 or 1,000 people worldwide who would potentially be our customers. No, I think the pool is much smaller than that. And if we've reached 10% of the market, and we are the only supplier, if we've reached 10% of the potential market, then the potential market is probably only 200 people. Maybe 250 globally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have a good spread. I mean, I have customers in America, in Australia, in most of the Scandinavian countries, in Italy, in Germany, in France, and also Japan. But as I say, it's there mm-hmm. are few. Well, you can tell they are few and far between. So. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Well, yes, it does. I'd like to know the customers that have not reported, are you saying that they have not reported results or that they have reported negative results?
They've not reported at all.
Not reported at all.
Unless I email them directly, I tend to hear nothing from them at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Occasionally people say, oh, I've got a problem. My data log is playing up, or can I have can you send me a spare heater coil or some more chemicals, and which I do. Yeah. And we also have distributed a fair bit of stuff pro bono to people who I know are experimenting and on very, very threadbare budgets, sparrow's tears, as they say in Japan. I don't hear much back from them either. Mm-hmm. I must be a scarier person than I imagine.
Why do you think that is, that they are not sharing the results?
it's a mystery to me, Ruby. I am a sharer by nature, and I can't really see it. But then again, this comes back to the thing that Mike McCubry has said often, and I think it's a very, they are wise words, really. We're all keeping the same secrets from each other. Yeah, it's the curse of the Lennar field, really. Mm-hmm. Secrecy is, inventor's disease is a terrible curse. It really is, and it's holding the field back, in my opinion. Fortunately, the good thing, and an unforeseen outcome, by the way, is a lot of people who I regard as being the real giants of this business, the old guard, if you like, of Cold Fusion, and I'm not going to name any names, but they have begun to reach out to me and encourage me to do particular experiments. Some of these are really, you know, well past their best years. The last of the summer wine is gone, and I think that they feel that it's time for them to start talking about the things they know. Yeah. Mm. To ensure that then the ideas and the thoughts are not lost, and I encourage them and thoroughly applaud it, and I respect their confidence as where required.
Well, that's good to hear, Alan Smith. Talk about your early background in chemical engineering and how it prepared you to do these type of experiments, and then describe for us what exactly are you working on.
Okay. I left school at 16 and come from just an ordinary working class family in London. But I was very lucky. I had with five kids and I was the baby, and still am the baby. But my three brothers and my father were deeply, deeply into making things, engineering. And so we had a workshop at home and people were forever dismantling motorbikes and rebuilding them in different configurations. And my father was a very keen radio amateur and also a prolific builder of all kinds of inventions, clocks and so on. And so I could pretty much use a lathe and a milling machine before I went to secondary school at age 11. And I grew up in this sort of, you know, whole ferment of making and doing and discussing crazy things, you know, how we could build submarines or space rockets or whatever with my brothers. And I left school, I went to work as a lab technician, first of all, and I was very lucky because in those early years, I was mentored by two remarkable people, and I'm going to tell you their names. They're both dead now, but the first one was a bacteriology technician called Wilfred Whittle, who taught me so much about lab work and technicianing and, you know, how to everything that I needed to know in terms of lab skills almost came from Wilf Whittle. And then I went on and I was at the Chester Beatty Research Institute in London. And my boss there was a real maverick scientist called Peter Alexander, Professor Peter Alexander. And he kind of took me under his wing and he shared everything with me. He was an expert on radiation chemistry, on biology, on immunology. He was a kind of polymath. Somebody said of him, actually, one of his superiors said of him once, every institution needs a Peter Alexander, but hopefully they only have one. So that's the kind of guy he was. Yeah. Thanks to their intervention and their mentoring, I got inspired, went to night school, went to university, and I spent a period working, quite a few years really, working in on engineering projects. I was at one point in the 60s, I was working on a centrifuge project, which was for the Chester Beatty, but they seconded me out of the building to run around in an engineering shop because they knew that, you know, I was happy in that environment. And while working on the ultra centrifuge project, I was approached to go work at Harwell, which is the UK Atomic Research Establishment, on their centrifuge project. But I knew, because of my somewhat louche teenage lifestyle, I would never pass the deep vetting. too many nightclubs, and so on. So somebody who worked there said, once you're in this world, you can never leave, you know. And I never pursued that career path. And I went into polymer, working as a research assistant by now, working on polymer research. And I discovered the importance of catalysis. Catalysts are what make things happen, right? And, they are the magic key that fits the lock, that unleashes stuff. It opens up possibilities. So I have always been very interested in the chemistry of catalysts. And this has led me into... This is what led me into Lennar, which, looking at the presentations at ICCF 19, I went, by the way, because I'd been friends for a long time with somebody who's in the Rossi group. And, he encouraged my interest in Lennar, which had never, that had always been there at some level, but he stimulated my interest. I went to ICCF 19, listening to presentations, and I thought, these guys have got two problems. One of them is that they don't know enough about engineering. And the other problem is that they don't really pay enough attention to the idea of catalysis and finding the right catalyst. And because I regard Lennar as kind of, I call it super catalysis. Yeah, it's catalyst plus. So that has really dictated the path of my research, looking for catalysts that make stuff happen at, if you like, the nuclear level. And this has resulted in two parallel paths of work. One of them, due to a chance meeting with an American inventor, is that I've been working on hydrogen stripping catalysts that act on water. Yes, in other words, making the production of hydrogen and other chemicals very easy. And I looked at something which was kind of, this would take a long time to explain, Ruby, deeply unfashionable, it sounds terribly ungreen, actually using scrap aluminium cans, beverage cans, and a catalyst to make pure aluminium oxide, right, and hydrogen, right? The aluminium oxide, aluminium beverage cans are not recycled, as you might imagine. Collection is not recycling. 60% of maybe 70% of them are collected, but only about 15% are ever recycled. And the recycling of them is not a pretty process, really, because they're covered in lacquer and so on. And these lacquers release dioxins and furans if it's not done correctly. Anyway, over the last 3 years, working with a good friend here, my colleague Martin, in my lab here, I'm happy and fortunate to have a laboratory at the bottom of my garden. We have developed and refined this water stripping catalyst so that you can just add hot water and the catalyst and some cans mixed together, and you end up with pure aluminium oxide, high purity aluminium oxide, and copious amounts of hydrogen. And this is done without using any nasty chemicals at all. You could drink the water, you could eat the catalyst, and there are no emissions other than the hydrogen and the aluminium oxide. Zero, no CO2, nothing. And it's a funny thing, the purer the aluminium, the cheaper the scrap. Aluminium cans are available in bulk for a few hundred dollars a ton. Aluminium wire, which is also high purity aluminium, is down to $100 a ton, even though the aluminium price is, you know, $1,200, $1,500, $1,600 a ton, because the refiners don't want it. Yes, they really don't want it. So there's an opportunity. On the Lennar front, things are moving quite rapidly at the moment. I've started cooperating with one of the people I'll call the old guard for the moment, who is very interested in glow discharge work, as I have been for the last few months. In particular, increasing interest in glow discharge. And we are hoping to take to Stockholm to Mats Luan's energy conference, which is in the middle of June, the New Energy Symposium, where we'll be talking about both the hydrogen stuff, which we call the hydrogen mine, and don't forget the aluminium oxide. It's easy to get blindsided by the idea of making hydrogen, by the way. The aluminium oxide makes you the money. Mm. Aluminium oxide is worth five. If we get a ton of cans, we can make 3 tons of aluminium oxide, and it's worth five times as much as the cans were. So the hydrogen is almost free. But sorry, I got off topic here.
Nice.
We are talking about Lennar, and I hope to be able to show a quite remarkable glow discharge experiment done with very, very simple equipment, and talk about, and I want to do a show and tell, right, so that people can see every aspect of it, and the whole, there will be people there who are probably on the fringes, there will be investors there. I'm not looking for their money for Lennar at all. Though I'm looking for investors to pick up this hydrogen business, because I think it's a good idea. But I want to inspire people, really, and show them that you don't need $1 million and a huge laboratory to begin to look at some Lennar systems. You need $1 million to begin to commercialize one. Absolutely sure. But if you just want to hunt for effects, if you want to hunt the snark, then a few hundred dollars, you can do it. That's my plan.
Nice.
We should go on.
Alan Smith, you're going to be demonstrating a live glow discharge experiment at the New Energy World Symposium. That's Mats Luan's event happening next June 18th and 19th in Stockholm, Sweden. Correct?
That's quite correct, yes. Mats has put me in for both days, because I'll be presenting the hydrogen stuff that we talked about, but also a glow discharge experiment, which is, this is pure Lennar. I'm designing it in conjunction with one of the old guard, as I called them, of the Lennar field, and they may or may not want the name to be public. I don't know. But what it involves is very simple equipment. We're going to pass a glow charge through a tube containing very low pressure gas. It's almost like a neon tube, but without the phosphor, and probably running at something like 5 or 10,000 volts. In the middle, there'll be a piece of metal foil. When the glow discharge begins, then two things should happen. One of them is that the metal foil should glow very, very brightly and sparkle, in fact. You get sparkles on the surface. The other thing is it produces what might be described as anomalous radiation, what I think it was Edward Teller coined the term Michiganons. Yeah. And one of the characteristics of this radiation is that it does not do much to a Geiger counter. Geiger's almost as if it was neutron radiation. Yeah, the Geigers are very sluggish. But as you begin to pile shielding between the Geiger counter and the source, the glowing foil, so the radiation count goes up and up and up. And this sounds a little bit scary, but people who know much more about radiation than I do say, well, the strange thing is, you can saturate a Geiger counter and set all the alarms off, but it does not appear to be harmful. So maybe it's muons, cosmic rays or something like that. Who knows? Interesting experiment. And by June, I'll know a lot more.
Well, we look forward to hearing about that. You were fortunate enough to go to the recent Rossi demonstration held in Sweden. Can you talk about that experience? And do you now feel that he is developing a path to a real technology?
Andrea Rossi is probably one of the most difficult people you would ever meet. He has he has a well-developed inner Scotsman who makes his approach to experimenting very parsimonious at times. But he also suffers to a certain extent with inventor's disease. He doesn't want to let go of his ideas. But I think the probability that he has done something amazing in the Lennar field is much above zero. Yes, I must reserve a small smidgen of doubt, because when something is so amazing, it does demand extraordinary proof. But he has gone on. He has amazed quite a few people who are much more smart and knowledgeable than me, and they continue to be amazed. I was talking at the conference, which there were about 70 people there. It was very well attended. I didn't get much chance to talk with Andrea at all, because he was deluged by people who wanted a slice of him, investors and so on. And also I met a number of what might be described as his former investors there, who are still and licensees who are still very much on board. So he is a remarkable phenomenon. Andrea is a phenomenon. There is no doubt about it. And if anybody could pull it off, then he could. He is, as described to me by somebody who spent some time, lab time with him and so on, remarkably intuitive. This was what was one of the academic staff at Bologna, where, as you know, he spent some time. Not the person regarded as not Giuseppe Levi. This was another more senior academic, and he said to me, "It took me 40 years to learn how to go in this business from A to B to C to D." He said, I mentioned the possibility of A to Andrea, and he immediately arrives at D. He is so intuitive, it's almost spooky. Yeah, so there you go. I suppose.
Well, we do know that it was Sergio Ficardi who introduced the public to Rossi and essentially supported his work, and he was a senior physicist there.
That's right, in the astrophysics department. Yes, and much loved as well. Much loved. There were many tears were shed, you know, in the department by his colleagues when Sergio passed on. And in fact, I can tell you for a fact that in the astrophysics lab at Bologna, there is a hydrogen bottle, which was Sergio Ficardi's, and it's now become a shrine. They say that's Ficardi's hydrogen. You can't use that. You mustn't use that. That's Ficardi's. Yeah. So there you are.
Sergio Ficardi, of course, one of the early nickel light hydrogen researchers, in particular.
Yes, along with Piantelli. Yes, mm-hmm. One of the very first people to look at this. Yeah.
Well, Alan Smith, thank you for being with us. We wish you luck with your business, lookingforheat.com, and best wishes on your live demonstration of a glow discharge cell at the New Energy World Symposium being held next June. That would be June 18th and 19th of this year. So thank you, Alan Smith.
And thank you, Ruby. It's been a most enjoyable conversation for me. And thank you also for your good wishes about the live demo, because in show business, you always need a little bit of luck. Bye-bye, Ruby. And thank you.
We've been speaking with Alan Smith, director of lookingforheat.com, an online shop dedicated to supplying open science research with laboratory needs. That's it for today. Find more episodes of the Cold Fusion Now podcast on our website at www.coldfusionnow.org or subscribe on iTunes. Until next time, I'm Ruby Carrot.